Hello and welcome to Immigrantly. I am your host, Sadia Khan. I hope all of you are doing well, taking care of your mental health, following some kind of self-care routine. We've spoken about this on our platform. We hope to do a whole series on mental health, so stay tuned for that as we wrap up 2020. I hope 2021 is better, more peaceful, and we can heal through it. And now to today's episode, which is focused on immigration. No surprises there. It's no secret that immigration has been the hotbed for elected officials to advance their own political agendas. We've seen that with Trump administration in the last 4 years. Our guests today, Professors Adam Cox and Christina Rodriguez, point out the fact that the majority of the legal authority in immigration policy in America rests in the hands of the president. Christina is a professor of law at Yale Law School. She served as Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Office of Legal Counsel in the U.S. Department of Justice from 2011 to 2013. She's also served as a term member on the Council on Foreign Relations. Very impressive resume. Adam Cox is the Robert A. Kindler Professor of Law at New York University School of Law, where he teaches and writes about immigration law, constitutional law, and democracy. He's also served as the Karpatkin Civil Rights Fellow for the American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU, where he was involved in the racial profiling and public defender reform litigation. I am so impressed with their resumes and can't wait to ask them a number of questions. They are also the authors of The President and Immigration Law, which analyzes the historical and structural sources that explain the president's overwhelming power over immigration policy. I have started reading this book, and I can tell you this, it's an incredible read. It's a great framework for historical policy and constitutional understanding of immigration in the US. So for anyone out there who wants to strengthen their understanding of the legal framework of immigration policy in the US, this book is a must read. Can't wait to talk to the guests. Let's get started.
I will say, though, it's going to take quite some time to undo what the Trump administration has done, because we've only identified very high visibility changes, but they have managed to transform the system by controlling the bureaucracy through the Department of Homeland Security in ways I wouldn't even have thought of.
We've long had a kind of disconnect between the views of at least many citizens in the country and the policies and practices of our federal immigration policy.
So first, thank you so much to both of you for coming on Immigrantly, and I'm really excited because I have a number of questions.
We're so happy to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much for having us on the podcast today.
So, Christina, why don't we start with you briefly describing or summarizing the book for those listeners who haven't read it?
So the book, I would say, has two objectives. The first is to explain why it is that the president exerts so much control over immigration policy. If you watch the headlines, if you've watched them for the last 10 years, you'll see that who the president is has a lot to do with what American immigration policy looks like. But what we argue in the book is that that is not a new phenomenon. That's not a creation of President Barack Obama or President Donald Trump exercising the powers of some new emboldened imperial presidency. But instead, it's a deeply rooted historical phenomenon that arises from the structure of the law that has evolved over time. So that's the first main argument of the book. And then the second argument of the book and the second purpose of the book is to think about that phenomenon and to think about whether there's something problematic about the president having so much control. What are the ways in which presidential control leads to abuse? What are its virtues? And to try to think about what we might want a system in which the president is empowered to look like. And that leads us to propose a series of reforms to what we think is one of the fundamental dysfunctions or problems of the system today, which is that it's oriented around enforcement, and that the question of whether and how to enforce the law occupies a central role, but gives rise to lots of opportunities for abuse. And so that is the critique on which we end the book. But within each of those parts, there is a lot to explore and a lot to discuss.
Absolutely. And first, I want to thank both of you for writing this incredible book. I am reading it. And for someone like me, who did not grow up in the US, I grew up in Pakistan, it's a crash course of sorts on immigration history, immigration law, and current policies. What I've read so far is so fascinating to me, whether it's, you know, the president's role, as you pointed out, in immigration enforcement, or Congress's inability to bring legislative change. And then you also talk about bureaucratic apparatus that enforces immigration, which you've pointed out. But Christina, when you talk about reformation and the role of president, can you walk us through how you think this needs to play out? And here I would like to bring Adam into the conversation and ask both of you, what would the process look like in terms of expanding presidential power?
So I think our reform agenda that we discuss at the end of the book has two components. Maybe I'll just briefly say what they are, and then Adam can add the sorts of details that he thinks are most important to emphasize. The first is to acknowledge what we call the rise of the shadow system, which is a system of 11 million non-citizens who, because of their lack of immigration status in the United States, are deportable. And we argue that that is one of the primary sources of the president's power over immigration law, and also the source of the dysfunction that I highlighted before because of the untenable and oppressive circumstances it creates. And so the first prong of a reform agenda, from our point of view, is legalization of that population and creating mechanisms in the law that would prevent a shadow system from re-emerging. So that's the first component. And then the second is, once we've diminished the role that shadow system plays, how can we harness what's actually productive and constructive about executive power to make a better immigration system that is better than the one that we have now at responding to changing dynamics in the world, to adapting to the way the immigrant population changes, to adapting the way that pressures from the outside, crises, or other kinds of pressures affect American immigration politics. And there are lots of tools that exist in the regulatory state that we think could be brought to bear more effectively than they are. And so that is the constructive part of our agenda.
Let me add just one maybe concrete example for each of those ideas, I think, that are really important that Christina mentioned. First, an example going to the reforms around the shadow system. So on our account, you know, a big part of the future of immigration law is going to flow from efforts to shrink and ultimately eliminate the shadow system in order to change the way in which presidential power operates in the system. And I think concretely, you know, a lot of folks talk about one thing that is a critical step in eliminating the shadow system, and that's a large-scale legalization program. You know, you see candidate Joe Biden talking about it on the campaign trail. It's been discussed for a number of years across several administrations. You know, the George W. Bush administration itself talked about a legalization program. So that's on everybody's radar screen. But we think there's a second thing that needs to be on people's radar screen, because it's important not just to provide lawful status to people who are already living in that shadow system, but to reorganize immigration law to prevent its reemergence.
And how would you do that?
Right. To do that, I mean, there are a bunch of routes you could take, but one rather straightforward one is to kind of recover a piece of lost immigration law history. Because when the American project of immigration restriction first got off the ground in the late part of the 19th century and the early 20th century, when deportation as a regulatory tool was introduced into the system, nearly every ground of deportability in immigration law came with essentially a statute of limitations, right?
Hmm.
A break that said that once non-citizens had taken up residence and lived for some period of time in the United States, whether it's a year or 3 years, that they were no longer subject to those grounds of deportation. They moved beyond the ambit of immigration law. Now, in the middle third of the 20th century, nearly all of those statutes of limitations went away. And that's part of what creates the risk today, that even were you to legalize a large percentage of the 11 million unauthorized immigrants in the country, that future dynamics might lead to the recreation of a shadow population. And so what we need are, you know, things like statutes of limitation that ensure that non-citizens who live for prolonged periods in the United States ultimately obtain essentially legal security in their status to eliminate the possibility of the reemergence of the shadow system.
So, Adam, here I want to connect the shadow system with the rise of deportation state. And as you mentioned, this is the developments of the 21st century that you talk about in your book as well. Can you walk us through the rise of deportation state? And what I'm understanding here is that if we don't have shadow system, then the idea of deportation state will also diminish over time. Is that correct?
That's right. I mean, the role that deportation plays as a regulatory tool would be really different if we lived in a world where rates of compliance with immigration law were high. What makes deportation such a powerful, omnipresent, and in many ways cruel tool of regulation is the fact that, you know, half the subjects of immigration law are formerly deportable. And the way we got here, you ask, how do we end up in this present moment? You know, our story, our account of the history is that there were really three interlocking developments over the course of the 20th century that put us in this present position where deportation plays such an outsized role in American immigration law. The first change was the one I alluded to a minute ago, which was the creation of deportation as a tool of regulation. So it's hard for us today to even imagine a world without deportation as a policy tool, but in the early days of restrictionism, deportation was barely on the books and really insignificant as a practice. But that changed over the course of the 20th century, right? We proliferated so many grounds of deportation that they're hard to count. And today, you know, all non-citizens, even lawful permanent residents, green card holders, live their lives on a kind of probationary status.
Exactly.
And that the rise of that probationary status is a big part of what defines immigration law today. So the first change was really this legal one, which added deportation and made migration more of a probationary endeavor for many migrants. The second change was a bureaucratic one, where we built enormous enforcement institutions to back those deportation rules. And so we went from a world where there was really little immigration enforcement away from seaports, right? There was no border patrol even until 1924, to a world where today the Department of Homeland Security is showered with enormous resources, right? Gets more money than all the other federal law enforcement agencies combined, and has the capacity to deport hundreds of thousands of non-citizens every year. You know, during the height of the deportation rates during the Obama administration, for example, they were deporting 400,000 non-citizens a year. That's more people than are incarcerated in all federal prisons.
Right.
So those two changes, the legal one, which creates the deportation state, and the bureaucratic one, which builds an enforcement apparatus to enforce those rules, collided with the demographic reality of increased rates of unauthorized immigration in the final third of the 20th century. And that's what produced this enormous shadow population and essentially gave us the modern world of immigration law that we live in.
So I want to talk about a few things that you mentioned. One, the enforcement apparatus, and you've talked about their budget, you've talked about their authority. And it feels like we are constantly hearing stories of ICE agents violating laws that prohibit excessive force and, you know, denying migrants their rights and enforcing a more humane immigration policy. Yet these agents do it anyways. We've seen that time and again. Is there an effective way, in your opinion, as experts in the field, to hold ICE agents or any enforcement agency accountable to the law?
I can take that question and say that it's quite complicated. There are a variety of tools you could use, reformers, an administration could use to try to control the use of the law enforcement power by whether it's ICE agents or the Border Patrol. But they're difficult to bear. So I think we should start from the recognition, and this is something that we discuss in the book, that both ICE and the Border Patrol in themselves have what we would call a law enforcement culture, even a semi-militarized law enforcement culture, where their primary mission is to enforce the law, to use the tools that they have, the tools of arrest and detention and otherwise, to make sure that people who violated the immigration law are apprehended and then ultimately, if appropriate, removed. So that bureaucratic culture is something that has built over time. You could trace it all the way back with respect to the Border Patrol to its creation in 1924, when the people who comprised the Border Patrol in the early years were Texas Rangers or law enforcement officials taken from different walks of life. But that over time became professionalized through the kinds of resource allocation from Congress that Adam was describing and the gradual incorporation of technology to make them look more and more like something that resembles a military, though it's not quite to that extent. So that culture has been both fed by bureaucratic developments, but is also something that has been self-sustaining. And it's actually a culture that President Obama confronted when he tried to, or when he did initiate DACA. His first objective was to try to articulate priorities for enforcement. This is another way high-level officials could try to control enforcement agents by saying, here are the priorities for enforcement. Don't use your force against people who are not priorities. Use your time to go after those who are priorities. That proved to be extremely difficult to do through these paper documents. And so that's part of why the Obama administration moved to a program like DACA that established clear rules that constrained enforcement officials, took power away from enforcement officials, and gave that power to officials within the bureaucracy who granted visas. But that requires a lot of high-level management and a lot of political capital, frankly, to pull something like that off. So it is, in some ways, an exceptional move as opposed to something that could be done on a day-to-day basis. There are other methods that could be used to try to rein in some of these enforcement agencies. Congress could act to narrow their legal authority. So if they lack legal authority to make arrests under certain circumstances, or they lack legal authority to, say, police outside of courthouses or in school zones or things of that sort, then that can reduce their footprint. If they lack authority to detain asylum seekers at the border, or they're given tools to do something other than detain asylum seekers at the border, that could change the nature of enforcement. But a lot of that requires Congress to change the scope of the law, and then also to change the way they allocate resources. The last thing I'll say on this point is I think one of the most significant developments within the enforcement bureaucracy has been the increased reliance on detention in the process of enforcing the immigration law, both at the border and in the interior. So you have a massive system that detains people for months, years at a time while they're pursuing their cases. That's something that takes resources as well. Congress could reallocate the resources that are devoted to that and shift to other kinds of strategies for dealing with an immigration docket that has lots of cases on it. And so there are political choices that can be made outside of the context of supervising the bureaucracy. But all of these things are just partial ways of addressing the problem. And then there's one final barrier to accountability, which is sometimes we think about accountability coming through the courts. If someone has law enforcement authority and is not using it legitimately, but abuses it either by mistreating someone or unlawfully arresting someone or unlawfully detaining someone, that a lawsuit might be a way to hold that person accountable. But legal doctrines make it very difficult to hold officials accountable for exceeding the scope of their authority. A court might enjoin them from doing that, but holding them accountable through applications of damages and other kinds of remedies of that sort are limited in the law. And so that's a legal regime. that could be reformed in some way. And that's of interest, not just in the immigration setting, but in policing generally. It's a hot topic of conversation.
So, Christina, there are advocacy groups who have even talked about dismantling ICE. We've heard this. And from what you're saying, and my understanding of it right now, is that's almost impossible to achieve, because I am just trying to think through, how do we reconceptualize the idea of enforcement in America? What I see right now, and you rightfully pointed out, it's extremely militaristic to me, and to the point where it's unnecessary, right? So what do you say to people who have advocated for dismantling ICE, and how will that impact immigration enforcement in America if that were to happen, like sometime in future?
I do understand the impulse to want to uproot things from their roots and to just eliminate the vehicle through which enforcement policy is applied to people in this abusive fashion. But I think there are at least two limitations to an abolish ICE kind of approach that isn't just about reforming enforcement authorities and changing the allocation of resources and creating other methods for managing immigration that aren't just enforcement. The first is that it's hard to imagine a world in which we have immigration laws that restrict entry and exit, or really entry into the United States, and create grounds for removal. You have those laws, and they need to be enforced. And it is hard to imagine a political system completely undoing whatever enforcement machinery exists. I can imagine dramatic reform, but eliminating an agency altogether dedicated to reform seems to require just a wholly different vision of immigration law. And I don't know that we're there as a polity on that question. But then the second is, even if you were to eliminate ICE itself, we've been through debates like this before. Adam and I like to talk about this when we discuss this with people. Back in 2002, when the Department of Homeland Security was created, that was seen as an opportunity to get rid of the Immigration and Naturalization Service, the INS, which was in the Department of Justice and was a much reviled agency, much like ICE is today. I don't think it was nearly as powerful as ICE, and that has a lot to do with post-9/11 resource allocation to immigration and other kinds of enforcement. But some of the similar concerns arose, that it was an agency that combined an enforcement and benefits mission, so the former corrupted the latter, that you had not particularly well-trained officials, that they were overly enforcement-oriented and didn't exercise discretion often enough, and that they lacked professionalism. And a lot of those same critiques are made against ICE today. In fact, ICE is made up of a lot of former INS officials. So you change the organizational chart, you change the bureaucratic structure, but you really haven't changed the culture. And in some ways, Congress has made it worse by allocating more authorities and resources to it. And so anytime you want to abolish something that exists, you have to be careful about what you wish for, because you don't know if what takes its place might not end up being worse. And then if you haven't dealt with the first point, which is, what is the point of immigration enforcement at all? And is our political system going to demand that there be some? Then you're not really going to get where you want to go, which is to have a system that's much more humane than the one we have now.
Yeah, so here's my question for you then, and I will come back to what you just said, but how do you define a humane immigration system? Because I'm assuming everybody has a different definition, but I want you and Adam to give your perspective on what would a humane immigration system look like to both of you.
That's the million-dollar question. You know, and I think, I guess, let me give it some thought, but let me start by maybe avoiding the question a little bit by explaining, you know, how we conceptualized our approach to the book and how we thought about that question as we wrote the book. I mean, I think our goal in the book was to both unmask, in a way, the realities about how political power operate in the immigration system today, right? To debunk some myths, in order, in a way, to provide a handbook. You know, like one way to read our book is basically as a guide to those who seek to reform the system, so that they better understand the ways in which power have operated, so that they can better see how you might seek to make change. And I think, although we didn't often talk about the book this way, I think we approached the book in that way because both of us understand that people have very different conceptions about what constitutes a humane immigration system. And so, you know, we both believe that ultimately it has to be through the operation of a deliberative political process that we as a nation make decisions about what is going to constitute an acceptable humane system. I think what we see on display over the last 4 years is obviously like powerful evidence of what it looks like to run a system inhumanely. And I think each of us can identify, we might have slightly different lists, but you know, we have our own sort of pet lists of the practices that would be, you know, first on a chopping block if you were trying to figure out how to eliminate the worst forms of cruelty and promote humanity within the system. You know, so one place I would start, to go back to something Christina said earlier, is with the system of immigration detention for people who are in immigration proceedings. You know, that's a system that has grown enormously over the last 3 decades. You know, we've gone from a world where we detained really only a very small fraction of people who were in proceedings to a world where, you know, we detain nearly 50,000 immigrants on any given day, you know, huge numbers. And that system is one where there's really very little evidence that detention is needed to promote the goals of those who favor enforcement. So even if you adopt a perspective that accepts the idea that we need the sort of immigration enforcement we need, that we need people to show up for their proceedings, we need people to be complying with the laws, there's no really good evidence that detention, the way it's operating in America today, is needed to serve those purposes. So moving us away from the system of massive immigration detention would be a way to promote humanity in the system, I think. That would be one example. But I think we have resisted, I will say, so concrete practices are kind of easy for us to come up with a list. I think we we did resist when we wrote the book. We resisted the idea in the epilogue, say, of writing down a comprehensive substantive vision for what we thought an ideal American immigration policy should look like, because in part we thought that that might kind of undermine the value of the book as a handbook, you know, because we wanted it to appeal to people who didn't necessarily share exactly our vision for what immigration law should look like in America, but still shared some of the underlying goals, and so could use, you know, our analysis to build political projects that could promote reform.
How do you think public misconceptions around immigration policy feed into the kind of policy enforcement that we are seeing right now? And what kind of role do you think journalistic institutions can play in changing those perceptions? Because those perceptions feed into how Congress implements law and takes on different legislative initiatives. How do we change that? And how much of it has made things worse when it comes to immigration in the U.S.?
So that's a really tricky question to answer because there are a lot of things to disentangle. I do think that there are familiar assumptions with deep roots in our history that you see as part of any immigration debate. And our current president has trafficked in a lot of them, that immigrants produce crime, immigrants take away jobs, immigrants destroy our culture. And those immigrants bring disease. All of those strands have had different trajectories through our history, and some of them have more empirical foundation than others, specifically the economic dynamics that immigration produces. So I think that we see in immigration the same thing that you see in lots of other domains, and I think it has probably only gotten worse in the last two generations, which is that people have beliefs about immigration, which are impervious to empirical data. And so you can cite all of the studies that show that immigrants actually commit crimes at lower rates than native-born Americans, and that is not going to change the minds of people who think that immigrants produce crime. You can cite all the economic studies that show that the economic impact of immigration is actually fairly limited and can be ameliorated in certain ways, and that's not going to change the view of people who are suffering in some way that illegal immigration has caused the dislocation of the American worker. And so that just reinforces that immigration, maybe more than other policy areas because of the nature of its history and how it's so intertwined with our sense of identity is about political points of view and worldviews. And so I tend to think that, and I don't know exactly how to do this, but that the way to pursue immigration reform that is aligned with your concrete policy goals is to articulate a vision that somehow emotionally and viscerally resonates with people and counters what Adam and I, and I'm assuming most of your listeners, believe is an ugly and exclusionary image of immigration that is mostly, though not entirely, grounded on half-truths and mistruths. But that's a huge political project. And there have been moments in our history where appeals of that sort have triumphed. Hmm. But it's not necessary that they will. And I don't think data is going to be the answer to the political challenge. And then there's the second set of questions. And I think in some ways these are more tractable in a legislative process or within a bureaucracy. And that is that there are a range of interest groups that support various aspects of our immigration policy. And some of them combine with others to produce what might seem like irrational legislation, where you have protections for immigrant workers on the one hand, and then a small number of visas, which helps contribute to the rise of illegal immigration on the other. And those interest groups can have more or less influence on the political process, depending on how they interact with lawmakers and reformers. And so I think there is work inside the political process that can be done to say, for example, reduce whatever influence private companies that support detention facilities might have without characterizing what that influence might be, or to counter the influence that employers who are not interested in labor protections for immigrants might have. And that, I think, requires less vision than it does brass knuckle kinds of politics or trade-offs that might occur. I think also, though, that that requires a functional legislative process, and I'm not sure that we have that anymore or that we're going to have one after this election. So that is a kind of a caveat to the view that there's a lot that can be done internally, even if you're not going to change the fundamental logic of the system.
What I've seen in America is that there is two extreme perceptions about immigration right now, and they are pretty much along party lines, right? So Republicans believe that immigration is bad for the country, and that's the end of the conversation. And Democrats, on the other hand, at least their rhetoric shows that they are pro-immigration, although I would say that most of the policies that they've enacted in the past have not been as pro-immigration as I would like to think. I came here in 2000s. However you define the so-called legal immigration system, I went through that, and I can tell you it's extremely bureaucratic. It's grueling, it's time-consuming, and at the end of the day, as a naturalized citizen, for me personally, I think immigration system right now in America is pretty much based on racial profiling and on discrimination, no matter what your status is. As a naturalized citizen, I still feel extremely anxious when I go to airports, and that's something that I shouldn't be facing or I shouldn't be experiencing.
I think that that's right. And my husband happens to be a non-citizen of South Asian origin, and I have firsthand experienced the weighty bureaucracy of our immigration system. So I know exactly the grueling and sometimes humiliating nature of what you're describing, even for people who are sought after, supposedly, exactly, by the system, as well as suspicion at the airport, in the sense that that is always going to be present, no matter what the law on its face says, or no matter what, you know, principles of racial equality are supposed to obtain. And so that, I think, is a dynamic that extends well beyond who's in control of immigration policy, and has a lot more to do with the political nature of immigration in our society, which I think is probably impossible to transcend. And we cannot, you know, fully rationalize the system. I do think the first point that you made, though, about how Republicans as a party are anti-immigrant, and Democrats as a party are pro-immigrant, reinforces how difficult it is to come to a kind of consensus that might produce what Adam and I would say would be more humane immigration policy, because it's become almost tribal. And whereas you once had different points of view within each party about immigration, you could get cross-party coalitions for reform, and you had presidents like George W. Bush emphasizing the importance of not attacking Muslims after 9/11, that is now a one-sided dynamic, and it does not help the political culture surrounding immigration at all. And even if those were false promises, we've lost our ability to make them across partisan lines, and that is concerning.
This is something that I want to ask both of you. Do you think the mixed signals that presidents send to the population, the constituents, also leads to some of this gridlock or some of this divisiveness? Because as you pointed out, President Bush, although his rhetoric was all, you know, let's not attack Muslims and all, but then his policies were completely different, anti-Muslim, anti-immigrant. Do you think that we need to have a more consolidated message for general public to understand where America stands in terms of having a more humane policy? And also, do you think there is a need to educate people on U.S. foreign policy more honestly than we've done? How narratives are formed around U.S. foreign policy that can also aggravate how people look at the newcomers or the outsiders?
Yeah, so let me speak to at least the first part of that question. It's absolutely true that, you know, from presidents, we see what appear to be conflicting signals oftentimes. You mentioned, you know, George W. Bush as a prime example of that. We can even add, you know, Barack Obama.
Yeah.
Because, you know, President Obama was, you know, both a president who pushed for the inclusion of Dreamers in the polity and rolled out signature programs like DACA designed to protect large numbers of unauthorized immigrants from deportation, and at the same time was known pejoratively in the immigrants' rights community as the nation's deporter-in-chief, and presided over a greater number of deportations than any previous presidential administration in American history. So those kinds of contradictory aspects of individual presidential administrations are pervasive across time. I think we see them in lots of different contexts. I think part of what they reflect is what Christina, you know, was talking about before, which is the complexity of constituents' views about immigration policy in America, and the kind of recurring fact that, you know, national political elites across time have for, you know, decades been more open to immigration than the median voter in the United States. You know, we've long had a kind of disconnect between the views of at least many citizens in the country and the policies and practices of our federal immigration policy. And that creates these contradictions. I will say an additional factor, I think, that drives these contradictions is that we often talk in a kind of one-dimensional way about whether presidents are pro or anti-immigrant. And I think, you know, in one sense, today and over the last couple of decades, we see really, really sharp divides between Republican and Democratic administrations on the kind of pro versus anti-immigrant question. So if you look at the policies of Barack Obama and compare them to the policies of President Donald Trump, what you see is, you know, Obama adopting signature initiatives to protect unauthorized immigrants, the Trump administration adopting signature initiatives to exclude and block access to the country for many immigrants. So that leads us to characterize the Obama administration as really pro-immigrant in a way, and the Trump administration as really anti-immigrant.
Which it wasn't really.
Right. That's what I want to emphasize is, I think that, you know, when it comes to general immigration policies, you see these divides. But when it comes to questions of immigrants' rights and enforcement, there's actually much less distance between Republican and Democratic administrations today. You know, as you mentioned, you know, the policies that, you know, created the kind of security and screening apparatus that facilitate profiling in the immigration context. Those were signed into law, many of them, by the Clinton administration in 1996, right? And, you know, during the Obama administration, when immigrants went to court and challenged policies that permitted the prolonged indefinite detention of immigrants while their immigration cases were proceeding, it was the Solicitor General's office of the Obama administration that went to the Supreme Court and said, actually, the government can detain immigrants pretty much for as long as it wants. When Central American families approached the southern border and sought asylum and found themselves often with young children in detention, it was the Obama administration's Department of Justice that went to court and said, you know, young kids, even kids who are 3 and 4 years old, they don't need lawyers in immigration proceedings. So in that sense, I think, you know, one thing that's been true across the sweep of American history is that executive branch officials of both parties have often been reluctant to give away the discretionary power they have over immigrants' lives by agreeing to grant immigrants greater rights.
So let's bring in another stakeholder, the corporations. So we are continuing to see this influence of large corporations, especially on, I don't know if I can call it elitist immigration policies. This is most specifically applicable in the context of labor, the workforce, and which types of immigrants have easier paths coming into the country. There are many immigrants out there who are possible immigrants out there who don't have a path, and there isn't a way for them to come through so-called legal system. Immigrants who are considered skilled laborers or those who contribute to the white-collar workforce are given priority. What does this say about this country's capitalistic attitude towards reducing immigrants to the value of their labor? Because that to me does not sound humane.
So we don't take this on directly in the book, although we do discuss some instances in which employers' interests did drive immigration policy. So for example, we spend a bit of time talking about the Bracero program of World War II the decades after the war that was initiated by FDR and then Truman through treaties with Mexico to import Mexican workers to account for worker shortages during the war in the Southwest. And that was something that was promoted by growers in the Southwest. Mm. So the precursors to, you know, modern mega agricultural industries. And so what you see there is a willingness on the part of employers both to create massive contingent employment programs and also to tolerate high levels of illegal immigration that grew up around the program for various reasons, because that was part of sustaining their labor supply. And I think that that carries over into the dynamics that we discussed that have produced unauthorized immigration to the United States between, you know, the 1970s through the late 2000s, that interest in having a labor supply that wasn't necessarily endowed with rights that they could defend, or that was easy to move around, or in some cases exploit. And so those are perennial interests and are among the interest groups that I was invoking before that inform the way that immigration policy gets written. I do think that, and this is not a completely unrelated dynamic, but the other important dynamic that sometimes occurs that I think reflects the motivation for your question when immigration reform is being discussed is that it's important for American immigration policy to actually serve the national interest. And that means having high-skilled immigration, tech workers, software engineers, other kinds of highly skilled workers. And there's been a lot of pressure in immigration policy circles from technocratic types to shift our system towards one that actually values even more highly than it already does those kinds of skills, and devalues the kinds of relationships that actually make up the bulk of our immigration system, which is family relationships.
Right.
So even though immigrant labor is commoditized or treated as something for the interest, to serve the interest of the employers, we do actually have a system that enables family members to reunite with their relatives from abroad in a much more robust way than most other major immigrant receiving countries in the world. And yet there's constant pressure because of these corporate interests to focus on immigration as an engine of prosperity and as an engine of innovation, as opposed to understanding some of the human relationships and, frankly, the historical dynamics that you were asking about before that drive immigration, American foreign policy involvement around the world, and U.S. responsibility for the creation of refugees and things of that sort. There are two very different ways of thinking about how we should construct our immigration system. And they're not mutually exclusive, but they do, the emphasis on high value immigrants can crowd out the recognition of these other interests. And they always are in some kind of competition with each other.
Christina, I want to ask you about the, I think it's called Bracero program you just mentioned. This was abolished, right, at some point. This may have led to more undocumented immigrants coming in.
The reason the Bracero program was abolished, I believe it was in 1968 by Congress, was because lots of political pressure had built exposing the abuses of the program. And so even though the program meant that, you know, tens of thousands of immigrant workers from Mexico found employment in the United States, there are also all kinds of abuses in the housing conditions and the way they were paid or not paid. And there was actually a famous documentary called Harvest of Shame by Edward R. Murrow that exposed this back in the day when everyone watched the same TV channels. Lots of people saw this illumination of what was actually happening. And this was also coterminous with the civil rights movement in the United States, and it eventually led Congress to abolish the program because of its exploitation. But of course, as we discuss in the book, that also contributed to the rise of illegal immigration, because it's not as if all those workers suddenly disappeared, or the growers' interest disappeared, or that the dynamics of migration that had been created by the program no longer existed. And so that was perhaps an unintended consequence of what I think was an initiative meant to protect labor and even immigrants' rights and tamp down on some types of corporate interests. But it was one of the ways in which those interests continued to exert power, because it meant that the labor demand was still met, but through illegal immigration. And one of the things that suggests to me, and one of the things that we tried to do in the book by revealing the sorts of complexities that Adam was describing before, that there is constant tension between the interest in having respecting workers' rights or immigrants' rights and the interest in immigration in and of itself, and promoting immigration in and of itself, or in satisfying labor market demands, or in appealing to the political interests of people who might be skeptical of immigration on the one hand, but dependent on it on the other. And that muddies the moral waters a little bit, but it's part of what makes immigration policy maddening and really interesting to study at the same time.
And in your words, Adam or Christina, how would you explain the need to advocate for immigrants? I'm trying to understand what we should focus our energies on when it comes to immigration debate in America.
Wow, that's a challenging question, because, you know, the last 4 years have given us policy changes that across the board have moved us away from, you know, an immigration system that we would see as a functional and humane one. And so there's an overwhelming amount of stuff on which to focus, right? I think maybe, and I think our conversation today has done this a little bit, it's useful to divide up the organizing efforts into a couple of different, you know, buckets, because first there's organizing around humanity and enforcement itself, right? So if we accept the enforcement-driven structure of immigration law as it exists today, and this is something we talk about in the epilogue, then the real question is, how do we discipline the exercise of that enforcement power and make the system run as humanely as it can in a world where this enormous shadow system exists, right? That's one place to organize around. But of course, the larger project ultimately is to, you know, to change the structure of the system so that enforcement plays a less significant role. And that means, you know, moving towards a system that better reflects the pressures that produce migration in the first place and provide tools that allow the government to manage migration without the creation of such an enormous shadow system. And I think if we look back to the Obama administration, for example, what we can see is that organizing efforts around particularly sympathetic groups of immigrants, where people could portray immigrants as blameless for their lack of status and as among the most deserving of membership in society. So those ideas of moral desert and blamelessness played a big part in the successful organizing strategy around the Dreamers, I think. And so that provides like one, you know, one possible organizing route that people could take. But of course, you know, the reality of that approach is that it itself is exclusionary in some ways, because it requires that you single out a group of immigrants and deem them the most deserving. And that might foreclose reform opportunities that could help others' lives. And I think, so knowing how big of a tent it's possible to organize around and yet still actually get change legislatively or otherwise through our political process.
What do you think we can expect from a Biden presidency in terms of immigration policy? What are your expectations and how long do you think it will take for Biden to undo virtually everything that Trump administration has already put in place?
I think that there is a great deal that Biden administration could do from the beginning. I will say, though, it's going to take quite some time to undo what the Trump administration has done, because we've only identified very high visibility changes, but they have managed to transform the system by controlling the bureaucracy through the Department of Homeland Security in ways I wouldn't even have thought of, but that obviously reflect that this commitment to restricting immigration is a deep-seated one for the president and his senior advisors. And so that will has translated across all domains of immigration, all aspects of immigration. So it's not going to be easy. But there are a number of things President Biden could do. There are a bunch of executive orders or presidential proclamations that he could immediately rescind. For example, the so-called Muslim ban or the travel ban that still remains in place that he, you know, started, kicked off his inauguration with 4 years ago. That could be immediately undone. Other proclamations that restrict entry of different streams of legal immigration because of COVID could be undone. There are other kinds of enforcement policies that could also be reformulated. All of the policies at the border with respect to asylum seekers could be adjusted to recognize the potential for claims there, to try to address the root causes of what's happening. And instead of using detention and holding people across the border while their claims are processing, finding ways of temporarily admitting them to the United States in a more humane fashion, and then recommitting to the concept of refugee resettlement by restarting that program. These are all things within the president's power. I do think there are two drags on these possibilities. The first will come if we have a divided government, if there is a Republican Senate, because I think that, as Adam and I have discussed, as we emphasize in the book, lasting change has to come through legislation. And I think that a new administration will want to send it. I think the vice president has committed to sending a bill to Congress. But with the Senate in Republican hands, it's unlikely that anything other than the most cosmetic changes would actually get through. The one thing about that I will say, though, is that in looking at immigration reforms across history, it can take many years, even a decade, for reform ideas to make their way through. You need the right political opening. But if you haven't built the draft legislation and the coalitions and the arguments that can take advantage of that opening, then you won't get the major legislation. And so even though it might seem like banging your head against the wall, if you have a Congress that's not sympathetic to your goals, it can still be worthwhile drafting and proposing legislation. And then the other warning sign that I would flag is the courts. I expect that whatever a Biden administration chooses to do will be challenged in court. President Trump's immigration policies, many of them are mired in litigation. There's a lot that a president can do that won't be subject to judicial review, especially in the enforcement domain, and especially when it comes to manipulating the bureaucracy. But you know, the border wall, the asylum restrictions, efforts to crack down on sanctuary cities, all of those things are in litigation. And I expect the same thing to happen with Biden administration, just with obviously different plaintiffs. And we'll see how the judiciary, as it's currently constituted, receives these challenges to what will be portrayed as abuse of executive power. But that also will be a dynamic of the coming years, I believe.
So in the end, I will make this quick because I know both of you are extremely busy. If you were to describe America in a word or sentence, how would you do that?
I would say conflicted.
Yeah.
The one word. I guess the sentence is, at least with respect to our book, there are competing strains. One is a commitment to expanding the polity and taking advantage of immigration and respecting everyone's humanity. And the other is the concern for sovereignty and the interests of the people who are already here and wariness of what it means to change the nature of the country too quickly.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And Adam, you?
In a word, I guess. Well, I guess in a sentence, I'd say, you know, right now it's that we have not really one America, but two. You know, I think polarization is the thing that defines so much of political life in this country today and is so much of what defines, you know, these debates of the moment with respect to immigration policy. While we think the roots of presidential power reveal an institutional structure that, you know, has concentrated power in the president while still leaving room for political power to operate in many different locations. I think that's a unique thing about the American system. You know, states and local governments, which we haven't talked about, played a role. Congress is obviously still a critical player, even as the president wields all this power. But in all of those locations, it's really, you know, the same two Americas that are revealed. And so the fights that are happening in states and local governments over immigration policy are basically just identical versions of the fights that are happening at the national level today.
And where can we find your book?
You can find it through the Oxford University Press website, or of course through Amazon, IndieBound, which is another site for books. We actually have a website that has links to all of those places, and the URL for the website is The President and Immigration Law, which is the title of the book, and that also has other writings and recordings of appearances and various kinds of links that might be of interest to people.
It was definitely one of my favorite interviews, very informative and insightful. Don't forget to check their book, The President and Immigration Law. They mentioned Amazon. You can buy it from Amazon, but I would suggest buying it from a local bookstore. Until next time, when we have another incredible story. Oh, and by the way, guys, please support us through Patreon, GoFundMe, and buying our merch. All the information is already on our website, immigrantlypod.com. Take care.